that I've seen a lot of crap that corporations are capable of. Like, you know, I've studied running shoes that were supposed to lead to women's liberation and laptops that were going to start revolutions, and I studied the Beyond Petroleum BP campaign, but I have never seen anything quite as audacious as the campaign to rebrand the tar sands ethical oil.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message, wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seed? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Do you know that Bill McKibben was on a debate with one of these guys on BBC, and he compared the tar sands oil to fair trade coffee and free range chickens? Do you know that they're running ads on the Oprah network saying that by buying tar sands oil, you're helping to free women in Saudi Arabia? I'm from Canada, and let me tell you something. We don't have ethical oil in Canada. We have tar sands oil, which is like regular oil, but a whole lot dirtier. It ravages the earth as it is extracted. And it ravages the earth at the point of combustion, when all of that carbon, three times as much greenhouse gas is emitted than it takes to produce a regular barrel of crude, when all that carbon enters the atmosphere and destroys and threatens the lives and livelihoods of millions of people around the world. And it also threatens the earth when it is transported in pipelines like the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. It threatens waterways, drinking supplies, ranches, the land that people and animals depend on. Ethical oil is not an oxymoron. It's an outrage. It is an insult. It is an insult to the indigenous communities living downstream from the tar sands. It is an insult to the people who are on the front lines of climate change, whether they're people in Vermont dealing with historic floods, whether it's the people in the Horn of Africa facing historic droughts, whether it's people in island nations like the Maldives and Tuvalu facing cultural extinction, whether it's people living in countries dependent on melting glaciers like Bolivia. They dare to speak to us of ethics. So we don't have ethical oil in Canada. We also unfortunately don't have a government in Canada that is in any way interested in representing the interests of the vast majority of Canadians. The vast majority of Canadians care deeply about climate change. They say it again and again. They show it with their actions, with the ways in which they've changed their lives, but it doesn't matter because of the tar sands, because it undoes all of the actions that we do as individuals, because our national emissions are still up 30% from the time we signed the Kyoto Protocol, and all that time we've made a mockery of that agreement and a mockery of international law. I know you Americans love to idealize Canadians. I know you do. Let me tell you, my family are actually Americans, and we moved to Canada during the Vietnam War. I know all about it. But our government right now, the conservative government of Stephen Harper, elected with 40% of the vote, they're keeping the Bush dream alive. They are keeping the Bush dream alive. They don't represent us. They've decided that it is their job to act as the global advertising industry, the global advertising agency for the tar sands oil industry. They travel around the world selling their poison, their ethical snake oil. We used to pride ourselves on upholding international law, on raising the bar. Now we travel the world lobbying governments from California to Europe, pressuring them to lower their good environmental standards, their good clean energy laws, to open up those markets to that toxic crud they call ethical oil. Do you know that our environment minister has used the phrase ethical oil? Get real about Canada, guys. Our government is so deep in the pockets of the fossil fuel industry that we know that we can't appeal to them to stop the tar sands. They've developed just 3% of the potential of this massive carbon fuel, and you know what? They won't rest until they have it all. So because we can't appeal to them, we need a strategy to strangle the tar sands from the outside. we need to cut off the arteries that are fueling this monstrosity. First and foremost, the Keystone XL pipeline, which will never be built if we have anything to say about it. That's why there are so many Canadians here who are appealing directly to President Obama, asking him to prove his personal energy independence, demanding that he use his veto to make good on his 2008 election promise to take the U.S. off the path of dirty energy, a commitment for which he won the Nobel Prize. It's time he earned it. Standing with me, as you can see here on either side, are 50,000 Canadians who in just 3 days or so signed a petition organized by Avaaz calling on Obama to protect the world from our deadly oil and say no to the Keystone XL pipeline. So here's the other thing they're telling us. They're telling us that this will create jobs, and how dare we stand in the way of jobs during an economic crisis, because you know there's an economic crisis on. But here's the thing that we know. We know that the same economic system, the same economic logic that puts greed above all and liberates corporations to do as they please, that same economic model that is threatening to crash the global climate system is exactly what crashed the global economic system, which is why we don't have enough jobs. The Keystone XL pipeline will create jobs. Well, so will climate change. It will. It'll create jobs cleaning up the rubble. It'll create jobs rebuilding flattened houses and schools. It'll create more jobs fortressing our borders as we try to protect ourselves from the climate refugees fleeing from a crisis that we created with our greed and our emissions. We'll create some more jobs with climate wars to fight over the scarce resources. That's what happens if we keep doing exactly what we're doing, only more so. This matters because these historic protests that are wrapping up today and that we will continue in another phase in the weeks and months to come happen at the end of a long and painful summer of disasters. Floods, of tornadoes, of forest fires, hurricanes, record-breaking heat, parched earth, failed crops, and as we gather today, new tropical storms are gathering, and people are in that familiar state of huddling by their television sets, wondering if they will be safe. We don't really have summers anymore. We have disaster season, and disaster season just seems to be longer and longer. It feels like a lifetime ago that we watched in gape-mouth horror as BP's oil gushed into the Gulf of Mexico from a hole in the world that has yet to heal. We are here because we don't want to live this way, careening from disaster to disaster. Whether that disaster is created from the process of extracting the fossil fuels when they spill, or the ongoing, everyday, never-ending disaster that are the Alberta tar sands, or whether the disasters happen at a slight delay when we successfully burn those fossil fuels. We are here because we know that we can do better, that we do not have to attack our Earth with ever greater violence in order to live happily and fulfilled. We know that there are energy sources based on renewing and amplifying life, not sucking it dry. And that on this path, there are tens of millions of safe and dignified jobs, jobs that workers can be proud to go to every day. Jobs that the climate justice movement can fight for alongside the growing sector of the labor movement that has the courage to say no to dirty jobs and no to the Keystone XL pipeline. Thank you for sharing Labor Day weekend with us. Let us labor with all our hearts for this new day. Thank you.
One of the best ways that people try to control what a corporation does and to make them accountable is to become a shareholder. That way, at least once a year, you can go to the annual meeting and voice your concerns, as we'll hear today when Enbridge had its annual general meeting.
Welcome to Enbridge's annual meeting of shareholders. My name is Allison Love, and I'm the Corporate Secretary and Vice President of Enbridge. I would like to advise you that the meeting is being video recorded for Enbridge's records.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Arledge, and I'm the chairman and a member of Enbridge's Board of Directors. It's my pleasure to welcome you to Enbridge's annual meeting of shareholders, which I now call to order.
My name is William Davis. I'm a shareholder, and I don't get to this microphone very often because you're usually in Calgary. I want to speak to the advisory resolution on the approach to executive compensation, and I start by reminding us that this resolution actually results from shareholder proposals over several years seeking what is called a say-on-pay. The advisory resolution has appeared for about 3 or 4 years now. It gets tweaked every year by the board after getting advice from consultants. And we get about 25 pages in the proxy circular devoted to describing and justifying how we reward our senior officers. That describes the core principles being applied and the comparator group against which our executives are measured. And if you accept the premises that undergird the advisory report seems logical. However, there is a widely held perception in society, and I suspect even among shareholders, that senior corporate remuneration has spiraled to unreasonable heights. And I reference the shareholder revolts at Citibank and Barclays, and it's this matter that I wish to address. On January 2nd this year, the media gave considerable coverage to the fact that most senior executive officers in our corporate world had already, in 2 days, earned an amount equal to the annual wage of an average employee. It's a very graphic contrast. And studies suggest that this shocking comparison is, in fact, an accelerating gap and is far worse in North America than in other parts of the world. The secular and business press are drawing attention to the consequences of this growing gap between the few and the many. One consequence is the gradual elimination of the middle class, and the threat that that poses to the future of capitalism. We are told that in the 2010 recovery in the U.S., 93% of the gains were captured by the top 1%, where incomes grew by 11.6%. The incomes of the 99% grew by 0.2%. I feel that the entire remuneration program is based on the fallacy that we can segregate our senior people into a comparator group with other overpaid executives and accelerate their remuneration beyond the income growth of ordinary people or other staff. Marcel Côté, who writes a column in CA Magazine back in 2007, nailed this problem as far as I'm concerned. I'm going to read a part of one paragraph from his article, "Are CEOs Overpaid?" In a paragraph entitled, "A Fictitious Market," and this is what he says. Salaries have little bearing on a CEO's decision to stay or go. Boards rely on peer comparison to determine CEOs' salaries out of a sense of fairness for their CEO, not because they are driven by market forces. Unfortunately, this concern for horizontal equity has led to considerable vertical inequity. And I think Mr. Côté has got to the heart of the dilemma which every board in North America faces. Each year, our comparator group focuses on horizontal equity. We compare our senior people to senior people in like corporations. We want our people to be rewarded in a competitive way, just as other corporations do. So since we strive for above-average performance, we end up with above-average remuneration, and since no corporation is striving for below-average performance, the program creates an upward spiral. No one looks at vertical equity. No one asks, are we paying too much to begin with, related to the rest of our staff, or to the world where most people live? So as one who believes in capitalism has been an effective vehicle for wealth creation and distribution, I really fear we are in serious danger of undermining the entire system. Society cannot survive a widening gap between the few and the many, or the steady disappearance of the middle class. The paradigm has to be changed. We can no longer set a small group apart, away above their own staff, above senior people in government or academia, or other fields of endeavor. So from my vantage point as a shareholder who benefits from Enbridge's success, I want to close with an appeal to the board and to management. Listen to what the world is saying in its say on pay. It is too high at the top. Create a new paradigm that includes vertical equity as well as horizontal equity, one related to planet Earth, where most of us live. Do this for the good of Enbridge and its long-term future. Do it for the good of society and all our stakeholders. Do it as a responsible corporate citizen. The entire corporate world is locked into a paradigm that is folly. Someone has to begin to introduce a note of reality and leadership, and why should that not be Enbridge? Now, this is the last time I'll see Mr. Daniel, so I really would like to hear his response, if he would.
One of the gentlemen that was director of this meeting, Pat Daniels, I couldn't get his estimated income for 2012, but in 2009 he made $6 million. This is Hugh McKenzie. He is a senior economist with Canadian Center of Policy Alternatives, and these are remarks from his latest report. This was first done in May 2012.
In the pit of the recession, the average income of the top 100 CEOs in Canada was more than $6.5 million. I think, you know, people pay attention to that. I mean, for example, the base salary for the CEO of one of the banks would be over $1 million.
Wow.
Then you add to that the annual bonus. Typically, the annual bonus will be the same as the salary. It's like you get $1 million a year just for showing up. And then you get $1 million a year on top of that for doing your job.
Well, thank you, Mr. Davis. I very much appreciate the comments and feedback. And certainly, I can understand what you're saying, and I'm sure that a lot of the messages that you're delivering resonate with many in the audience. I think it's fair to say that we at Enbridge do our very best to try to balance the performance of the company with the compensation of the executives within the organization. And I know that you're providing general comment on compensation on a very wide basis, and I'm sure that many in the room would believe that. I feel, and I'm sure that the board of Enbridge feels, that the compensation of this company has been very much in line with the performance. The examples you gave are examples of not particularly strong performance relative to what we've seen at Enbridge. We do everything we can to try to ensure that we compensate fairly, to your point, and also to the point where we can attract the kind of people to continue the performance that we've had in the organization over the years. So, again, I think that we're much in line and as a matter of fact, relatively conservative on the compensation front compared to our peers across North America, our industry and other industries.
This resolution must be approved by ordinary resolution of the common shareholders. An ordinary resolution is passed if it is approved by at least a majority of the votes cast. We'll conduct a vote by ballot. And I'll ask Ms. Love to explain the procedure. I have received confirmation from the scrutineers that the resolution has passed. Accordingly, I declare the resolution carried. The company would like to thank the shareholders for their support of our approach to executive compensation. In the next year, the board will discuss how often to ask shareholders for their support on our approach to executive compensation. We will provide you with the percentage of votes for, against, or abstained at the end of the meeting, and the exact number of votes for, against, or abstained through the filing on SEDAR. The next item of business is a shareholder proposal submitted by NEI Investments along with two co-filers. They request that the board provide a report to shareholders by May 2013 describing, among other things, how the board has assessed the risks associated with the First Nations and the Métis Group's opposition to the Northern Gateway Pipeline Project, the impact of the risks on Enbridge's final decision to pursue Northern Gateway, and the manner of mitigating those risks should Northern Gateway proceed regardless of the opposition. Enbridge does not support this shareholder proposal for the reasons outlined in detail in the Management Information Circular.
Today we're listening to Enbridge's shareholder meeting, May 29th of 2012.
May I have the NEI Investments representative present their motion?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jamie Bonham. I am a proxy holder for NEI Investments, and I move that the Board of Directors provide a report to shareholders by May 2013 at reasonable cost and omitting proprietary information that details how the Board has assessed the risks associated with First Nations opposition to the Northern Gateway Pipeline, Northern Gateway. The report should discuss how First Nations opposition will factor into the final decision to pursue Northern Gateway. If the project will be pursued regardless of opposition, the report should entail how the company will mitigate the operational, reputational, and legal risks of such.
With a little bit of research, it's easy to discover that 50% of NEI investments are owned by Desjardins Credit Union, which we have here in Hamilton. So if you have retirement portfolios, you might want to check into the way that they earn the money for your retirement. If you're against companies like Enbridge, you don't like environmental damage, you don't really know if you're supporting them or not unless you do some detailed research.
Thank you. Is there a seconder of that motion?
Monsieur le Président, mon nom est Rosalie Vendette. Je suis détentrice d'une procuration et j'appuie la proposition. I second the motion.
I understand that a representative of NEI Investments who submitted the proposal would like to make a brief statement at this time. Please state your name, confirm you're a shareholder or proxy holder, and please make your statement.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jamie Bonham. I'm a proxy holder for NEI Investments. And thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to address the board and shareholders in regard to our resolution. I'd also like to acknowledge at this time the co-filers of the resolution, Desjardins Investment and Vancity Investment Management. As you may know, NEI has been a long-term investor in Enbridge, and we've enjoyed a respectful and productive engagement with company management and staff over these years. NEI currently holds around 148,000 shares in its ethical funds portfolio. And I'd like to make that point clear. The company has and continues to be an important part of our portfolio, and it is with an eye to ensuring the continuing success of the company that we have filed this resolution. We have met with Enbridge management over the past year to discuss our concerns, but could not reach an agreement. At the heart of our proposal is the concern we have over the significant risk that First Nations opposition poses to the Gateway Project, and beyond that, the risk that faced the company as a whole as a result of this opposition. Enbridge provides a good deal of information about Gateway, but does not address this vital issue adequately in this disclosure. There appears to be a fundamental divide between the plans of the company and the expressed aspirations of many of the communities along the proposed pipeline and tanker route. The opposition appears to be significant, widespread, and hardening daily. It seems likely that this will result in extended litigation that could ultimately go to the highest courts, and that it will be years before the litigation is settled. Should the company prevail in these court cases, there remains the question of how the pipeline is going to be built in the face of statements from many communities that the project will under no circumstances be allowed to pass through their territory. Ultimately, the strength of this opposition risks a situation in which long-term damage is done to the reputation of the company. And to that last point, Enbridge has spent considerable time building a reputation as one of the more progressive companies in the energy sector and has built this reputation while earning substantial returns for investors. This reputation benefits all aspects of the business, from acquiring a social license to operate to recruiting key talent. Damage to this reputation has ramifications for the business as a whole. This is not a hypothetical scenario. Controversy surrounding the Gateway Project is already creating harm to the company's reputation and has the potential to do much more. That's why we filed this resolution, and we feel it is the responsibility of the board to inform shareholders how it is planned to mitigate the risks of First Nations opposition to the Gateway Project and whether the company plans to proceed with the project in the face of this opposition. The risks we raise are real, significant, and facing the company in the here and now. We look forward to the board's response. Thank you.
Chairman, my name is Bill Manzan. I'm a shareholder. I'm not sure I'm going to support this resolution as stated, but I do suggest to the board and the executive that it underlines a very fundamental question, and that is that we should be given full and fulsome disclosure of the various issues involved in this pipeline project, which is extremely important to the company and to the country. And I'm getting at things like governmental approvals, working with the government, and just a general need for full disclosure. I have to say that maybe I wasn't negligent reading some of my previous shareholder material. Until I read the answer of the company here, I must say I did not have really a good understanding of the various hurdles that you face. And I think it's in your interest to let the shareholders, also the general public in Canada, and to the people who you're dealing with who claim to have interests, that we be briefed periodically, probably through the quarterly reports at a minimum, and if there are material developments from time to time, so we understand this, and so that the general public, who I think you need more support from, are aware of what is going on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You've heard the motion, which has been seconded. Is there any further discussion? To pass the resolution, it must be approved by an ordinary resolution of common shareholders with the approval of at least the majority of the vote cast. And we'll conduct the vote by ballot.
Many shareholders, of course, will have previously voted their proxies, and those have been counted already. So if you've previously voted, you don't need to vote again. Please take a moment to examine the yellow ballot. You are to vote either by placing an X, either for, against, or you may abstain by voting on the motion today. And after completion, please sign the ballot with your usual signature, and the scrutineers will collect it. To ensure that we do have a proper record of this vote, we would appreciate it if all the ballot forms were returned.
I have received confirmation from the scrutineers that the resolution has not passed. We will provide you with the percentage of votes for, against, or abstained at the end of the meeting, and also provide the exact number of votes for, against, or abstained through a filing on SEDAR. We have completed all the scheduled business. Thank you for your strong show of support by attending the meeting, and I now declare that the formal business part of the meeting completed. I'm now pleased to proceed to the executive officer's remarks and the general question period. And I want to call on Pat Daniels, our Chief Executive Officer, to review the company's operations over the past year and comment on the future activity.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, everyone. And let me add my welcome to the Chairman's welcome for all of you being here for our 2012 Annual Meeting of Shareholders. Before I get into my presentation, just let me say that I would like to express my appreciation to NEI for their proposal and the information provided. We appreciate the work and effort that has gone into the shareholder proposal. We hear the message, although it did not pass, we hear the message you provided and with regard to the comment made on it, and maybe I can chat with each of you after the meeting. Before I get into my presentation, it's a requirement, a regulatory requirement that I advise you I'm going to be looking, using forward-looking statements. So if any of you can read this fine print, that's what it tells you. I will be looking, using forward-looking information. What I'm going to try to do today is provide just a very brief recap of 2011 and the performance of the company over that period of time, then review quickly the first quarter of 2012, which we announced this morning, and then finally talk about the strategy going forward for the company. Let's begin with a brief look back at 2011. And I think, put simply, 2011 was probably the best year ever in the history of the company. We were the largest single contributor to the Toronto Stock Exchange composite through the year. Our total shareholder return for 2011 was 40%, which truly was a remarkable year in what was a down year. Earnings grew by 11%, and we increased our dividend by 15% through the year. We paid out over $759 million in dividends to our shareholders through the year in 2011. We injected nearly $5 billion worth of capital into the Canadian and U.S. economies to our capital budget over that period of time. And we're very pleased with our strong safety and environmental performance in 2011. We developed a new informal program of operational risk management and mitigation in 2011. That program encompasses six areas: and each area is absolutely critical to the success of the company. And I'm going to go through these one at a time, but integrity management, critically important to us. Third-party damage avoidance with regard to our infrastructure, very important. Leak detection, incident response, worker occupational safety, and public safety and environmental protection.
Kalamazoo River, 1 year later. This is the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams. Workers are still trying to clean up thick tar sands oil that has settled at the bottom of the Kalamazoo River. It's been 1 year since more than 840,000 gallons of oil leaked from a broken pipeline owned by Enbridge Energy. Lindsay Smith reports life for those living near the accident site has not returned to normal yet.
See those clumpies?
Deb Miller points out black, goopy masses as big as my fist floating on the Kalamazoo River. We're behind Miller's carpet store in the village of Soresco, 6 miles downstream from where the pipe broke. Most of the oil that's left is submerged below water. There are around 200 acres that state regulators still classify as heavily contaminated. This is one of the worst. Here, I can still see oil clumps everywhere, in the water, on the banks, on strips of bright orange boom. Workers in neon vests dot the riverbanks. I pick up a faint smell, sort of like nail polish remover. Miller says she certainly doesn't sit out and enjoy the view anymore. She's used to waking up to the sound of airboats and helicopters. She's still drinking bottled water because she's worried her well could become contaminated. Miller's learned more than she's ever cared to know about pipelines and wishes she could move away from her nightmare.
The home that we live in was my husband's family home. But if it was up to me, I would have been gone the week of the spill.
Many have left. Miller says that's changed her neighborhood forever.
I don't blame anybody for getting out. There's too much unknown. There's too much unknown.
I try talking to people really close to the spill site. Door after door, no one answers. Some of the homes are obviously empty. 3 people answered the door but refused to talk to me. A big black SUV pulls up as I'm walking back to my car. Self-described outdoorsman Craig Ritter jumps out and introduces himself. He's from Jackson. He's been kayaking this section of the Kalamazoo River for years. He says the river looked like black death the day after the spill happened.
The river was black. You couldn't even hear the water. The water going over the rocks didn't sound like water going over the rocks. It almost sounded like a kid sucking on a super thick milkshake. I mean, it was just...
We go behind an abandoned house with a porta-john for workers parked in the driveway. Ritter says the river looks a lot better on the surface. Then he pokes a stick into the shallow water. A blue oil sheen bubbles up, along with some black tar-like substance.
Not horrible or what? I'm gonna go for a swim?
No one has been able to fish or swim in this part of the river for a year. Officials hope to open part of the river to recreation by the end of next month. Ritter looks down, wipes the sweat from his forehead, and shakes his head.
Unfortunately, I don't think life on the river is going to be the same.
In downtown Marshall, I meet Reynald Stone. He goes by Big Ray. He and his son, Little Ray, cool off in the shade near a city fountain. Big Ray tells me the oil spill didn't change his life too much. His son chimes in, though, reminds his dad they haven't gone fishing at all this year.
Actually, they float, they get their floaties on, they float inside the river with their fishing poles and fish. Now they messed that up. Can't do that no more.
Enbridge promises they're here until the spill site is clean. But Big Ray is cynical. He thinks Enbridge is going to do whatever it has to get by, and that's it. So he's not too sure he'll let his son go swimming or fishing in the river anytime soon. For the Environment Report, I'm Lindsay Smith.
Our objective is to ensure that we are top quartile or best in class in each one of these 6 areas. And you're going to hear a lot about us measuring up to those 6 going forward. One example of some of the work that was done under this program in 2011 relates to integrity work on our crude oil pipeline system. And this is one example only. We conducted 1,764 integrity digs. And 138 inline inspection tool runs, making us far and away the industry leader in terms of inline inspection and integrity digs. And that's only one example in one area of the 6 through the year. Our adjusted earnings reached $1.1 billion in 2011. Our investment proposition, which I referred to as the investment triangle at Enbridge, of reliability, income, and growth for shareholders continued to deliver excellent results through the year. As you can see from this slide, no matter what time period you look at, Enbridge has significantly outperformed our sector peers and the markets. We've achieved a compound average return to shareholders of 14% for 59 years, so a very long track record. Early in 2011, we announced agreement on our landmark 10-year competitive toll settlement with our shippers on the crude oil mainline system, a very significant move forward for us. New business for liquids pipelines also came on strong last year with more than $5 billion worth of new projects secured. And this slide shows some of the examples of that new business, projects like our Flanagan South project, Seaway with our joint venture partner Enterprise, and the Athabasca Twinning leading the way. For gas distribution, very relevant to this Toronto audience, the 2011 story was about continued customer additions and strong performance under incentive regulation. The gas distribution business contributed 15% of Enbridge's adjusted earnings in the year. In 2011, the newly secured projects for gas pipelines reached $2.3 billion, including our entry into the Canadian midstream business with a $1.1 billion investment in the Cabin gas plant in northeast British Columbia. Other gas highlights from 2011 include our joint venture on the 580-mile Texas Express NGL pipeline. That's from Skellytown down to Mont Belvieu in Texas. We also brought several green energy projects on stream in 2011. Specifically, and very relevant again in Ontario, Amherstburg and Tilbury solar projects, the 99-megawatt Greenwich wind facility in Ontario, and the 250-megawatt Cedar Point wind facility in Colorado. In addition to that, we announced investment in the 300-megawatt Lac Alfred wind project in Quebec. That's our first renewable or green energy project in Quebec. And finally, we entered into a new business for Enbridge in 2011. That was power transmission with our $300 million investment in Tonbridge and a 300-megawatt Montana to Alberta tie line. So 2011 was a very good year by just about all measures. 2012 has also started off very well, as we announced this morning. We've indicated more than $2 billion in additional expansion projects secured so far this year. Some examples of that being the upsizing of our Flanagan South project, including twinning of the Spearhead Pipeline, twinning the Seaway Pipeline from Cushing to the Gulf Coast. And this, by the way, is going to give producers about 850,000 barrels a day of capacity from Cushing to the Gulf Coast, much needed in this current environment. And our first entry into the solar power business in the U.S. with a 50-megawatt Silver State North solar facility in Nevada. So we're in this wind and solar in the U.S. now. And that was only in the first quarter, by the way, those accomplishments. There's a lot more to come through the remainder of the year.
If you listen to these numbers that this Enbridge director is throwing out, and he says things like, we've got all these pipelines landlocked in North America from one end to the other, it doesn't make any sense to me, because he's also talking about how they invested in other forms of renewable energy. So why don't they take all their money that they have and maybe cut back on those $6 million paychecks to CEOs like Pat Daniels and invest more of it into making renewable energy that it does not harm the planet? It's really that straightforward. The public is begging for it. The shareholders are asking for it. But these guys are up there talking down to them and ignoring reality. Harper, he is selling poison to the world, as Naomi Klein said. There's no doubt about it. The world wants energy. There is a way to get it without having to damage the planet. That's what we're doing here with this dirty fossil fuel, killing ourselves and the planet in the process.
Also in the first quarter, we again raised the dividend by 15%, which represents the 17th consecutive year that we've increased our dividend. Our adjusted earnings in the first 3 months of 2012 were $376 million, and that provides an excellent start to the year, and it positions us very well to meet our overall guidance of $1.58 to $1.74 per share. Looking beyond 2012, Enbridge has the largest suite ever of growth prospects in front of us, and it extends across all of our operations. Between now and 2015, we've got $14 billion of new projects that will come on stream, and we've identified another $30+ billion of very promising opportunities that are in various stages of investigation at this point. As a result of all of that, we're confident that we're going to be able to achieve 10+% annual earnings per share growth through the middle of this decade. So where do we see that growth coming from? Well, I think the first place to look is liquids pipelines. And if you look at our asset map, it shows a very strong geographic positioning on crude oil pipelining. We have effectively hardwired the second or third largest crude oil reserve in the world in the form of the oil sands to the best market in the world, and that's the American Midwest, a landlocked market. Our main line also directly accesses Bakken production, and our system reaches markets down to Cushing, and as of next week, all the way to the Gulf Coast. Our 10-year competitive toll settlement is another competitive advantage on that system because it provides toll certainty to our customers and allows us to extend the reach of our liquids pipeline network. We've already got a very strong competitive position in the Athabasca region thanks to connections to 8 oil sands projects. In addition to $3.6 billion in secured pipeline projects currently, we have an additional $3 billion of opportunity in the region over the next 2 years. In the Bakken, the tremendous pace of drilling and growth in production means increasing demand for pipeline capacity, obviously. We've got initiatives under construction now, which will double our export capacity to 435,000 barrels a day by early 2013. And we're currently developing the next expansion beyond that for North Dakota, another large increment to our system by 2015. Later in the decade, we see growth from the Northern Gateway Pipeline Project, which will very fundamentally diversify the markets for Canadian crude oil. And by the way, crude oil is Canada's largest export by being able to reach the growing Asian markets. This project has attracted very vocal opposition. You're all aware of that. However, I'd also like to point out that a recent Ipsos poll just released by Canadian Chamber of Commerce shows that the vast majority of Canadians, about 75% of Canadians, feel that we do need to diversify our crude oil markets and to get away from reliance on the United States. As strong as that market is, that we need to broaden out that market. The regulatory review on Gateway is in progress, and we hope to have a formal decision by the end of 2013. It still seems like a long way off, but that's when we would hope to have a decision. Over the past 10 years, we've held over 2,500 public meetings on Gateway, 123 open houses, 150 presentations, 64 workshops on Gateway alone, and through that we've met directly with 17,000 people. And I think that's one of the reasons why we feel our disclosure around a lot of the Gateway-related issues have been very complete. We've already signed equity agreements with 22 of the 45 Aboriginal groups and communities along the route. And as I've said before, we want to and hope to get all on side on the project. Our gas business is also well-positioned at Enbridge. Alliance currently transports gas from the Montney Shale Play in northeast British Columbia and the Bakken, and it passes directly through the emerging Duvernay play in Alberta, and that has a very liquids-rich gas stream, which is very much sought after in this day and age. In the U.S., our Anadarko system in Texas and Oklahoma holds a premier position in the liquids-rich Granite Wash region, and as I mentioned earlier, the Texas Express NGL pipeline will effectively secure long-term access to a premium NGL market for our producers in Texas. Electricity demand is expected to grow significantly across North America, so we see ample opportunity for us to continue to grow our green energy business in the years ahead, adding to the 8 wind farms that we already operate, the 4 solar facilities, 1 geothermal facility, and 1 fuel cell operation.
8 wind farms, 4 solar energy spots, $300,000 investment for alternative energy. This man made over $6 million in 2009, and he's made well higher than that considering the amount of increases he's talking about. We need alternative energy. We need them to take their money and put it into alternative energy. And usually it's the citizens asking the government and the government forcing the corporations to do just that kind of thing, but not in Stephen Harper's Canada.
Moving on to the international front, we're working with several producers and industry participants in Colombia at this time, where we were before and were very successful in Colombia. and we're evaluating their greenfield crude oil pipeline project from the main producing basins in the Llanos out to the West Coast to effectively do in Colombia what we're talking about doing with Gateway in Canada, and that's being able to access Asian markets for Colombian crude. Our gas distribution customer base continues to grow, and I don't need to tell people in Toronto how much Toronto continues to grow. We're still adding between 35 and 45,000 new customers every year, and we expect to welcome our 2 millionth customer in 2012. To support future growth and enhance system reliability, we're going to undertake a Metro Toronto expansion project at a cost of $300 to $500 million. And that's to serve a lot of the new condo developments, which are pretty obvious in this city today. Moving on to some very general comments before I conclude. In my view, energy is a great enabler. In fact, in my mind, the defining difference between the developed and the developing nation is the wide and ready availability of inexpensive energy. Our Energy for Everyone Foundation provides tangible proof of the life-changing impact that energy has for people in developing countries, and we have projects currently underway in Africa and Central America. Here you can see some of the images from Energy for Everyone's recent work in Costa Rica and Peru. Both of these projects included Enbridge employees who volunteered their time to help install, in this case, solar lighting systems to people that have access to no electricity at all. Having participated in one of those projects, I can tell you it has a huge impact on people when they do not have access to energy. In North America, of course, many people take for granted or are simply unaware of the vast energy infrastructure that enables our society. So we, I think, have a habit in North America of saying no to proposed energy projects rather than seeking a balanced and sustainable development. Many people say, not in my backyard, but energy infrastructure has to be in somebody's backyard if we're going to take advantage of it. Even green energy requires large-scale development. In my mind, we can't say no to energy infrastructure and then say yes to lights, to cook food, to school buses, to ambulances, and all of the benefits that come along with that.
I'm Susan Connolly, resident of Marshall, Michigan. We're here in Battle Creek, which is an area that has been impacted by the tar sands bill. From July 2010, Enbridge Pipeline 6B ruptured, spilling approximately 1 million gallons of tar sand crude. Talmadge Creek and the Kalamazoo River, the 40-mile span, is still closed to this day. There's a no-contact order to this day. If we try to put our hands in this river right now, you'd get in trouble. It looks beautiful, but it is not. At the time of the spill, my children were at a daycare center within a mile of Talmadge Creek and the Kalamazoo River. My son had throwing up. My daughter developed a very strange rash on her body. There were headaches, nausea, vomiting, upset stomach. We had a burning sensation in our throat, burning in our eyes. This is the first spill of its kind, the largest in Midwest history. So this is the perfect opportunity to learn from it, study from it, especially with the proposed Keystone Pipeline that's going to run the same horrible crude. Before you approve it, study it, research it, learn from the mistakes that have been made here to be prepared for what's going to happen in the future, because it's not a matter of if there will be a spill, it's just a matter of when. It will happen, it's going to happen, and just be prepared.
Anyway, minimize the sheer economic scale of this. I mean, this has the capacity of employing up to 30,000 people on both sides of the border. This is a huge energy project that will have enormously positive employment and economic activity effects across a range of industries in both countries, which is why business and labor are so strongly supportive of it. Secondly, we talked about this earlier, anywhere than from Canada. Right? It's just, the third is that the environmental impacts of this should not be exaggerated. You know, oil sands oils, while they are heavy in emissions, are no heavier than typical heavy crudes, no heavier than Venezuelan, for example, which is where a lot of the displaced oil will be from. Not that there aren't environmental challenges in the oil sands, they are, but they should not be exaggerated or somehow unique or somehow out of the mainstream of the oil industry.
My husband and I own a carpet store right here in Sarasco. It's located at the top of the dam. Our business was closed for 3.5 months. The impact financially to us was incredible, incredible. And it's not only that short-term impact, it's long-term. You know, how do we get that business back? And business owners need to be aware of that. That break put 1 million gallons into our river, changed our communities forever. We're looking at houses that are sitting empty. We're looking at our property values that have declined. What is that doing to our tax base, our public safety, our schools, whatnot? What happens there?
First notice was the children vomiting. They'd complain, my head hurts, my eyes hurt, and all of us had that. But they started vomiting, and it would be a brownish, blackish material. The oil companies will say, oh, it's just a pipeline, it's no big deal. But as you can see, it devastates. And that's the message that I want America to realize. It's something that has to be studied independently, and it needs to be taken extremely serious. This is not Grandpa's old crude.
I could smell the oil. It was very strong in the apartment. Their kids was getting sick on it. They was taking their babies to the doctor. My eyesight, I did the best of what I could with pine saw and bleach to scrub that oil smell out of here. How you know them pipes ain't gonna break again? Then we got another case.
We are the world's first and largest laboratory for tar sands crude. And we are now into the 2012 cleanup year, which is now going to concentrate on the submerged oil problem, trying to still quantify it and trying to determine exactly what harm the oil will do to the river system. We think that this example, particularly the expense, will indicate to pipeline companies that they can't take as much for granted as they have in the past. We know there are parts of the pipeline system to the east in Michigan supplying refineries that are going to utilize 1953 vintage pipelines. There were too many people with the hubris that if it hadn't happened, it won't happen. There was no application of the precautionary principle. And we have an old pipeline, we'd better fix it, we'd better lower the pressure, and we'd better watch it carefully.
We went to a pre-hearing yesterday in Lansing. Enbridge is proposing to run additional pipeline through at least 3 counties currently. It's understood that the pipelines that they're going to be building will be running tar sands. I don't think the communities are aware of what is going to be occurring. They don't realize the severity of it and just how detrimental it can be. The only ones who are going to benefit are the pipeline companies. They talk about jobs and job growth. The only job growth that I have seen for this pipeline are the workers that are here cleaning up the spill. We just hope that people will learn from it. Before you continue to run tar sands through pipelines or propose new pipelines, be better prepared and study it. Just hold off until you know just what you're dealing with.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams. We're coming up on 2 years since a pipeline owned by Enbridge Energy ruptured. More than 840,000 gallons of tar sands oil spilled into Talmadge Creek and the Kalamazoo River. The Environmental Protection Agency says most of the oil has been removed from the creek and the river, but there's still oil at the bottom of the river. This spring, the company, the state, and the EPA will be figuring out how much oil is left and where it is.
The pipeline break location was approximately 0.5 mile upstream from here.
Mark Ducharme is with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. We're standing on a 2-lane road looking out at Talmadge Creek.
Shortly after the spill, you couldn't actually even see the creek. If you were down in this location, all you would see is oil. These banks were heavily oiled as well. So just catastrophic damage.
He says things have come a long way at this site. Enbridge moved the creek out of its normal path. They actually diverted it and ran it through a pipeline. Then they dug up the contaminated creek bed. Now the creek is back in place. Enbridge put in clean soil and then added seeds from native wetland plants. Little green shoots are pushing up through the ground. But there's still a long road ahead. Mark Ducharme says Enbridge has more restoration work to do at Talmadge Creek. And then the DEQ will require long-term monitoring.
Can we replace it to the exact condition it was prior? Probably not. But can we go back and put something back that will be an acceptable ecosystem? That's the expectation.
Ducharme says tar sands oil is very heavy and very thick, and that's made the cleanup more difficult.
We're writing a book on how to clean up oil sands out of freshwater, cold water streams and freshwater systems. We've been looking elsewhere. We've been trying to find other examples. They're just not there.
The work crews have had an ongoing struggle of trying to find and remove oil from the bottom of the Kalamazoo River. Ralph Dahlhoff is an on-scene coordinator with the EPA.
We can tell that there are smaller and smaller amounts of submerged oil in the river, and we just need to be careful that as we continue to tease that out of the river, that we don't hurt the river or the river sediments or the animals and plants of the river anymore.
Talmadge Creek and parts of the Kalamazoo River are still closed to recreation. The local county health departments hope to reopen portions of the river sometime this spring or summer. Ralph Dahlhoff says the EPA estimates more than 1.1 million gallons of oil have been removed from the creek and the river. That includes oil that soaked into soil and covered plants. Now, that number is quite a bit higher than what Enbridge says was initially spilled, which is roughly 843,000 gallons.
But I can't comment on that difference because the amount that was estimated to have been released is the subject of a number of ongoing investigations.
The EPA has an official investigation, and the National Transportation Safety Board is also investigating. Enbridge has its own investigation into the cause of the pipeline break. Jason Mancham is a company spokesperson.
We have not released those results. Everything really is hinging on the results of the NTSB study, which has been delayed until later this year.
He says Enbridge won't release those results until after the federal government issues its findings. Mancham says Enbridge is committed to trying to get the area back to the condition it was in before the spill. The cleanup, restoration, and monitoring could continue for several more years. That's the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams.
Good afternoon, Chief Martin Louis, shareholders, investors, human beings. I want to stress human beings because we all have children. We all have children that's going to has to live for the future. I was raised to respect everything, the land, the water, people around you. I respect everything that you guys are doing. You accomplish a lot of things in your lives. I respect that. But when it comes down to our water, our land, destruction of it, because there's some spills just about every day, I'm just wondering how far are you and the government going to go in destroying part of the humanity? That's what's going to happen. Everyone, you know that. All the shareholders, investors, you all got children that's going to live for the future. The amount of money you guys make, you can be able to do things in a safe manner. And I know the country of Canada is run by industries. It's always done that ever since the first beaver that was shot years ago. And it kept on growing. They destroyed our land at home with the Kenny Dam to put out energy. And it's continuing, and it's time. Yankadene, when we talk about Yankadene people, I'm talking about people of the earth, talking about all of you. Every one of you have a stake in the future. How far are you willing to go, you and the government, in trying to stop us? What is it going to take? Because we're not going to go away. I want to make it sure that stakeholders, investors, banks, we want these things too, but not in a destructive way. You're destroying humanity. That's what it is. You're talking about the world here. You're talking about the whole world. How far is a company willing to go to destroy our country? Oil spill happen every day.
Chief Louis, if I could respond,
We feel very much that we are enabling exactly the kind of life that we all want. And certainly the idea of destruction doesn't have any place at all in our discussion. As I mentioned, the energy that we provide, the energy that we move, is so critically important to society as an enabler. It's improved the lifestyle of people and their longevity for ages and will continue to do so. There's a direct correlation between the use of energy and the well-being of the people. We have to do it safely, and we can. There is no better operator in the world than Enbridge. We operate more crude oil pipelines than anyone. You mentioned the money. I've said this before with regard to the opponents of Gateway. We could, if the oil doesn't move to the West Coast, it'll move somewhere else. Because we're the biggest transporter of crude oil, that business would come to us. So whether we make the money going west, going east, going south, it doesn't matter. It's not a money issue to us. It is, we think, very important for Canada to broaden out its market and not be totally reliant on the U.S. And we want to find a way that we can do this that can bring to you, to your children, to your grandchildren, the kind of benefits that energy does. And
it is money. No matter how you look at it, it's money. Money for everybody. That's why your shareholders are here.
We agree with you. Thank you.
Redefining Radio.
Sync FM.